Shadow said that he did. He saw something else as well. Chad Mulligan was in love with Marguerite Olsen himself. He wondered if the man knew how obvious it was. Mulligan pulled out once more, lights flashing, and pulled over some teenagers doing 60. He didn't ticket them.
Just put the fear of God in them.
That evening, Shadow sat at the kitchen table trying to figure out how to transform a silver dollar into a penny. It was a trick he had found in perplexing parlor illusions, but the instructions were infuriating, unhelpful, and vague. Phrases like, "then vanish the penny in the usual way," occurred every sentence or so. In this context, Shadow wondered, what was the usual way? A French drop, sleeving it, shouting, "Oh my God, look out, a mountain lion," and dropping the coin into his side pocket while the audience's attention was diverted? He tossed his silver dollar into the air, caught it, remembering the moon and the woman who gave it to him. Then he attempted the illusion. It didn't seem to work. He walked into the bathroom and tried it in front of the mirror and confirmed that he was right. The trick, as written, simply didn't work. He sighed, dropped the coins in his pocket, and sat down on the couch. He spread the cheap throw rug over his legs and flipped open the Minutes of the Lakeside Council, 1872 to 1884. The type, in two columns, was so small as to be almost unreadable. He flipped through the book, looking at the reproductions of the photographs of the period, at the several incarnations of the Lakeside City Council therein. Long side whiskers and clay pipes and battered hats and shiny hats, worn with faces which were, many of them, peculiarly familiar. He was unsurprised to see that the portly secretary of the 1882 City Council was a Patrick Mulligan. Shave him, make him lose 20 pounds, and he'd be a dead ringer for Chad Mulligan, his, what, great-great-grandson? He wondered if Hinzelman's pioneer grandfather was in the photographs, but it did not appear that he had been city council material. Shadow thought he had seen a reference to a Hinzelman in the text while flipping from photograph to photograph, but it eluded him when he leafed back for it, and the tiny type made Shadow's eyes ache. He put the book down on his chest and realized his head was nodding. It would be foolish to fall asleep on the couch, he decided, soberly. The bedroom was only a few feet away. On the other hand, the bedroom and the bed would still be here in 5 minutes, and anyway, he was not going to go to sleep, only to close his eyes for a moment. Darkness roared. He stood on an open plain. Beside him was the place from which he had once emerged, from which the earth had squeezed him. Stars were still falling from the sky, and each star that touched the red earth became a man or a woman. The men had long black hair and high cheekbones. The women all looked like Marguerite Olsen. These were the star people. They looked at him with dark, proud eyes.
"Tell me about the Thunderbirds. Please. It's not for me. It's for my wife."
One by one they turned their backs on him, and as he lost their faces, they were gone, one with the landscape. But the last of them, her hair streaked white on dark gray, pointed before she turned away, pointed into the wine-colored sky.
"Ask them yourself," she said.
Summer lightning flickered, momentarily illuminating the landscape from horizon to horizon. There were high rocks near him, peaks and spires of sandstone, and Shadow began to climb the nearest. The spire was the color of old ivory. He grabbed at a handhold and felt it slice into his hand.
"It's bone,"
thought Shadow.
"Not stone. It's old, dry bone."
But it was a dream, and in dreams, sometimes you have no choices. Either there are no decisions to be made, or they were made for you long before ever the dream began. Shadow continued to climb, pulling himself up. His hands hurt. Bone popped and crushed and fragmented under his bare feet, cutting them painfully. The wind tugged at him, and he pressed himself to the spire, and he continued to climb the tower. It was made of only one kind of bone, he realized, repeated over and over. Each of the bones was dry and ball-like. For a moment he had imagined they might be old yellow shells or the eggs of some dreadful bird, but another flare of lightning told him differently. They had holes for eyes, and they had teeth which grinned without humor. Somewhere birds were calling. Rain spattered his face. He was hundreds of feet above the ground, clinging to the side of the Tower of Skulls, while flashes of lightning burned in the wings of the shadowy birds who circled the spire. enormous black condor-like birds, each with a ruff of white at its neck. They were huge, graceful, awful birds, and the beats of their wings crashed like thunder on the night air. They were circling the spire.
They must be 15-20 feet from wingtip to wingtip.
Then the first bird swung out of its glide toward him, blue lightning crackling in its wings. He pushed himself into a crevice of skulls. Hollow eye holes stared at him. A clutter of ivory teeth smiled at him, but he kept climbing, pulling himself up the mountain of skulls, every sharp edge cutting into his skin, feeling revulsion and terror and awe. Another bird came at him, and one hand-sized talon sank into his arm. He reached out and tried to grasp a feather from its wing. If he returned to his tribe without a thunderbird's feather, he would be disgraced. He would never be a man, but the bird pulled up so that he could not grasp even one feather. The thunderbird loosened its grip and swung back into the wind. Shadow continued to climb.
There must be 1,000 skulls. 1,000,000. And not all of them are human.
He stood at last on the top of the spire, the great birds, the thunderbirds, circling him slowly, navigating the gusts of the storm with tiny flicks of their wings. He heard a voice, the voice of the buffalo man, calling to him on the wind, telling him who the skulls belonged to. The tower began to tumble, and the biggest bird, its eyes the blinding blue-white of forked lightning, plummeted down toward him in a rush of thunder, and Shadow was falling, tumbling down the tower of skulls. The telephone shrilled. Shadow had not even known that it was connected. Groggy, shaken, he picked it up.
"What the fuck?"
shouted Wednesday, angrier than Shadow had ever heard him.
"What the almighty flying fuck do you think you are playing at?"
"I was asleep."
"What do you think is the fucking point of stashing you in a hiding place like Lakeside if you're going to raise such a ruckus that not even a dead man could miss it?"
"I dreamed of thunderbirds. And a tower. Skulls."
It seemed to him very important to recount his dream.
"I know what you were dreaming. Everybody damn well knows what you were dreaming. Christ almighty! What's the point in hiding you if you're going to start to fucking advertise?"
Shadow said nothing. There was a pause at the other end of the telephone.
"I'll be there in the morning,"
said Wednesday. It sounded like the anger had died down.
"We're going to San Francisco. The flowers in your hair are optional."
And the line went dead. Shadow put the telephone down on the carpet and sat up stiffly. It was 6 a.m. and still night dark outside. He got up from the sofa shivering. He could hear the wind as it screamed across the frozen lake, and he could hear somebody nearby crying, only the thickness of a wall away. He was certain it was Marguerite Olsen, and her sobbing was insistent and low and heartbreaking. Shadow walked into the bathroom and pissed, then went into his bedroom and closed the door, blocking off the sound of the crying woman. Outside, the wind howled and wailed as if it, too, was seeking for a lost child, and he slept no more that night. San Francisco in January was unseasonably warm. Warm enough that the sweat prickled on the back of Shadow's neck. Wednesday was wearing a deep blue suit and a pair of gold-rimmed spectacles that made him look like an entertainment lawyer. They were walking along Haight Street. The street people and the hustlers and the moochers watched them go by, and no one shook a paper cup of change at them. No one asked them for anything at all. Wednesday's jaw was set. Shadow had seen immediately that the man was still angry and had asked no questions when the black Lincoln town car had pulled up outside the apartment that morning. They had not talked on the way to the airport. He had been relieved that Wednesday was in first class and he was back in coach. Now it was late in the afternoon. Shadow, who had not been in San Francisco since he was a boy, who had only seen it since then as a background to movies, was astonished at how familiar it was, how colorful and unique the wooden houses, how steep the hills, how very much it didn't feel like anywhere else.
"It's almost hard to believe that this is the same country as Lakeside."
Wednesday glared at him. Then he said,
"It's not. San Francisco isn't in the same country as Lakeside any more than New Orleans is in the same country as New York, or Miami is in the same country as Minneapolis."
"Is that so?"
"Indeed it is. They may share certain cultural signifiers, money, a federal government, entertainment. It's the same land, obviously. But the only things that give it the illusion of being one country are the greenback, the Tonight Show, and McDonald's.
They were approaching a park at the end of the road.
Be nice to the lady we are visiting, but not too nice.